Welcome to the Influential Women Podcast, the podcast where we chat to women who motivate and inspire us. This is Nikki Bannerman, and my influential woman today is Viv Groskop. Hello and welcome, Viv, and I pronounce your name properly.
Not an easy name to pronounce.
I don't have your incredible linguist skills. Now, Viv is a well-known writer, journalist, comedian, author, and podcaster. Now, you are one funny lady, and as a stand-up comedian, you have performed one-woman shows at the Edinburgh Fringe and been a funny woman finalist, and a So You Think You Are Funny semi-finalist. So you think you're funny, and I'm pronouncing your surname, I'm sorry, in a very funny way, and I know you've mentioned before that you've pronounced it wrong yourself, because it's quite a hard one, isn't it, to get your tongue around?
It's very simple, really. It's just Groskop. Groskop. And it's just got too many consonants in it, so people get confused. But it's like, I always think, like, Mariella Frostrup. It's like Mariella Frostrup. No, nobody ever pronounces Frostrup wrong. The combination of Viv and Groskop always trips people up.
You got your name, I think, from the descent of your grandfather. You'd mentioned on social media the question if you could have one last meal with someone special who you've loved and lost. And I'm sorry to mention that. Where would you go? And you mentioned your lovely granddad, didn't you, and what you'd do.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, of course, my name is from my father's side, although I'm married. I didn't take my married name, kept my own name. So Groskop is my father's name, my grandfather's name on the paternal line. And when I was growing up, I didn't know where this name was from. Of course, you know, many years later, I discovered it's pretty bloody obvious. It's Jewish and it's Polish. But when I was a child, this was never, ever mentioned. Forget the name of, there's an amazing book that has just come out and I've forgotten the name of the book, which is really annoying because I would want to recommend it to people. But it's a book of writers talking about the person that they've lost, who they would most like to have a last lunch with and what they would like to say to that person. And I thought if I were to have that last lunch, it would be with my grandfather, and we would have to have banana sandwiches with the crust cut off because that's pretty much all he used to eat because he had false teeth and he couldn't chew anything. And the question I would ask him is, do you really believe with a name like Groskop that we are not Jewish? Because that's always been a massive question in my mind. Of, it wasn't discussed in my family and it just seems so extraordinary to me. I grew up in Somerset, and of course, it's not a massive hotbed of Jewish immigrants in Somerset, or at least it wasn't in the 1970s. So it was just never mentioned, and I never met anybody who said, oh, your name's Jewish, or you must be one of us, kind of thing. Whereas if I'd have grown up in North London, of course, I would have known it straight away. But yeah, it's always an extraordinary thing to me. I was very close to my grandparents, and, you know, it's the one thing we didn't talk about.
Oh, isn't that lovely? And lovely memories of your granddad. And I think it might, is it called Lost Lunch? I'm sure I saw something. I think it is called Lost Lunch, and I think it's just such a lovely way for people to think, isn't it, that actually if you've lost that lunch, particularly in the current climate, who would you really want to have a lunch with that you miss? And I think that's a lovely way to think, so people can contemplate. They talk about, you know, where you'd go, what you'd eat, what you'd say that you've never said, and it's quite thought-provoking, isn't it? Also on Twitter, I saw that you gave some funny lockdown tips as a 1-2-3 formula. Do you want to touch on those? Do you remember what those were?
Oh yeah, well, I've been thinking a lot about how people can have a quick fix, like a quick mental fix in lockdown, because, well, or whatever it's going to be called now, like post-lockdown, or, you know, waiting for the second wave, whatever we're going to call it, just so that you can, anytime you're having a bit of a low moment, you can think to yourself this really short, small thing that will give you a bit of a jolt. You know, like the way they have, I think they use it in Alcoholics Anonymous, they have this thing called HALT, which is H-A-L-T. So you have to think, are you hungry? Are you angry? Are you lonely? Are you tired? And if you're any of those things, then halt and pay attention to your feelings. And then, you know, you won't think about having a drink. And so I wanted to have like a lockdown equivalent of halt. And I thought of this idea of 1-2-3. So anytime you're thinking to yourself that you're having a low moment, you just think 1-2-3. And it's to remind you that number one is you need one oxygen mask. And I don't mean that literally, although plenty of people are needing oxygen masks literally at the moment, but I mean a metaphorical oxygen mask. So it's the idea that that is the one thing you really need to have going for you, is Have you thought about what you really need if you put your needs first before anyone else? Because unless you're wearing your own oxygen mask, whatever that means for you, then you won't be able to help anyone else. So have you put yourself first in some way? So number one is, have you got your one oxygen mask? Have you done the stuff that you need to do for you to keep yourself sane? Number two is, you need two best friends. And this is because I was thinking of all the people that I'm talking to and what's giving me the most comfort and reassurance. And really, it's always knowing that I have one friend I can speak to who's like a really good old close friend, like somebody who knows me inside out, like a personal friend. And that I also have at least one other friend I can talk to who's connected to my work, who understands all the challenges of what I'm going through, what I've lost in my working life, what I'll be going through, you know, somebody who can really understand that. So one personal friend and one work friend, ideally from outside the people that you're living with, if you're locked down with other people, because I think we're sort of all leaning on our immediate people very strongly at the moment, and it's good to have people outside of that circle who you're checking in with. So one oxygen mask, two best friends, and 3 units of alcohol. And the 3 units of alcohol is a reminder of the absolute maximum that you must drink at any one time. It doesn't mean you have to drink 3 units of alcohol immediately now, but it's a reminder of maybe don't drink more than 3 units of alcohol if you can help it. As a man, you can freely drink 3 units every night and be safely within government guidelines. As a woman, if you drink 3 every night, then you've really exceeded. We're supposed to have 14 units a week maximum, and it's 21 for men. So I think when you do have a drink, try not to go above 2 or 3 units, not every day. And then you don't even have to think, am I drinking too much?
And you came up with all that. I think there's a book in that as well. I think that's a great, and that was quite a sensible, you know, from your comedic, but obviously you've got your journalist background. That's a very sort of sensible thought through and very now and what everyone's feeling. You know, we are all those things, you know, hungry, angry, you know, lonely, tired, frustrated, and it alternates throughout every day, doesn't it? So I think that'll help people out there to just think. And friends are so important. I don't think they've ever been more important, have they?
Oh no, I mean, it's such a lonely time for people. I think it's very isolating, and I don't just mean physically. I think this is a very mentally isolating time, where even if you're lucky enough to be around people, and I've got lots of friends who are on their own, and I think they're getting a bit more used to it now, but in the early days I think it was very difficult if you live alone to go through this, and you're used to having the sociability of your workmates, and all of that's taken away from you. And for older people as well, who are on their own at home and they're used to going and socializing in shops and breaking up their day, all of those things are taken away, and those are our comforts and our distractions. And for all of us to be stuck at home, whether we're physically with people or not, we are mentally isolated from our normal routines. And I say this with, you know, the greatest of respect for the really terrible things that lots of people are going through. But for people who are, in inverted commas, not going through terrible things, you know, who don't have someone in hospital or haven't been physically ill themselves, I think it's really, really mentally challenging, this period, because all of your routine is cut off. And also, to some extent, your future is cut off, because the future is completely uncertain at the moment. We don't know how long any of this is going to take. We don't know what the world is going to look like when we come back into it. I was just reading this morning that the latest forecast is that 170 countries worldwide will be in recession. It's an international phenomenon. There is nowhere that's untouched by this. And for all of us, we're living through this for the first time. So it's a big mental challenge.
Definitely. And I don't think, you know, people should underestimate that. And it's okay to not be okay, and minute by minute and day by day. And I think our podcast has certainly helped that. So as a master of language, as you've just demonstrated there, and both as a comedian and as a linguist, you speak Russian and French and left Cambridge with a first class degree. So you're certainly no fool. Credible chat. So we're going to talk fiction. We're going to talk about your lovely new book. But this year you joined some other influential women, Martha Lane Fox, Scarlett Curtis, Justice Melanie Eusebi, who's been on our podcast as well, and Paula Hawkins as a judge of the 25th anniversary Women's Prize for Fiction. How was
Yeah, that? It's great. So I was really honoured to be part of this. Just so people know which prize we're talking about, it's now called the Women's Prize. It used to be called the Orange Prize. So that's still probably how quite a lot of people refer to it. So it was the Orange Prize for much of its 25-year history. Then it was briefly the Bailey's Prize. Now it's the Women's Prize, and they're in their 25th year. And it's my first time judging. Martha Lane Fox is the chair of the judges. It's her second time. And yes, we're a merry band of five of us with, Scarlett Curtis, Melanie Eusebi, Paula Hawkins, Martha Lane Fox and me. And we've been working on this for maybe almost a year now, actually, probably since last September. We've known that we were going to be judging the prize. Normally, we would be meeting round about now and getting ready to announce a winner in June. But the whole process has been put off, as people can imagine. Normally, there's a huge party in Bloomsbury in this beautiful, I think it's called Bloomsbury Square Gardens, where they always have a party. It's gorgeous. That's normally in June, and that's, of course, cancelled.
So you've been at home reading loads and loads of books. Have you? How many books have you had to read to in order to judge some of them there?
They're probably... I would several hundred books are eligible. About 200 books are eligible for this prize, or at least they get entered. Probably more than that would be eligible. It's open to any woman who writes fiction in the English language. Anybody who writes in English, so works in translation, are not eligible. And every publisher has an allocation of how many titles they can send in. So they can't send absolutely every single woman that they've published. They have to choose. And then we can also call in books that we want to have considered. Yeah, so it is a massive... It's a massive task. I would say it's as big... I haven't been a judge on the Booker Prize, but it's as big a list as the Booker.
Definitely.
So in terms of the reading for the judges, it is one of the biggest commitments out of all the prizes that I've judged. And I've judged quite a lot. And this year it's going to be announced, the winner's going to be announced in September. So we've got our short list of six at the moment. And it's been an incredible year for women's fiction. So it was a very, very strong shortlist of 16 titles. And now it's down to six titles on the shortlist. And even going from that 16 to six was horrific. We had
different opinions as well, I should think.
Yeah, because there's, you know, some huge names were on the list. If people compare the long list to the short list, the people who've got pushed off were, you know, absolute world class.
Now, I know you're being modest here, but you've got a fabulous journalism background, including writing on popular culture and current affairs and helping women, and sometimes with a feminist slant. You've written for Esquire, Daily Express, The Guardian, Evening Standard, The Observer, Daily Mail, Mail on Sunday, Red Magazine, blogs on Downton Abbey and Poldark, and been described as one of the most successful freelance journalists in the UK. It's like, how did you get so good at writing and what you do?
Well, first 15 years of my career, I did journalism in-house at Cosmo, Daily Telegraph, Express. And I had like a regular kind of journalist job. So I was an editor and I was a columnist. And then because I was on the Express in my late 20s and it got bought out, I was able to go freelance because I had a redundancy payment. And that was a massive turning point in my life, because before then I felt really happy with what I was doing, and I love writing and I love being part of the whole newspaper environment in the late 90s. It was amazing. But I always felt very hemmed in an office environment, and I don't work very well in a team with other people. I wouldn't say I'm a massive diva, but I'm probably a bit of a diva. I need to be in my own space. And I think if I hadn't have had that kind of kick of being able, you know, kick up the arse basically, of getting a redundancy and being able to strike out on my own, I don't know if I ever would have done it, actually, because it takes a bit of guts to you know, cut off from a regular job. So yeah, I set up when I was freelance. I was about 26 or 27. I just got married and I was really determined to make a go of freelancing. And luckily, I think one of the most important things about freelancing, and I hope this is useful for people to think about now, particularly if their job situation is changing. I think there's so many job situations are going to be changing. If you're good at generating ideas and you don't mind rejection, or you can find a way to combat rejection, then freelancing is easy. You know, it isn't, there isn't so much money in journalism as there was when I first started out, because obviously then it was all pre-blogs, pre-internet. It was a completely different picture. So I'm thinking, when would that have been? Like kind of 2001 is when I went freelance. So before 2008 and the last crash, it was very easy to make a living as a freelance journalist. It's not so much now. But as long as you have, as a creative, loads of ideas, you have to be adaptable, you have to be able to take a lot of knocks, and you learn not to take any kind of rejection or criticism personally. I'm really easy with all of that. Then you can manage. It's really just about, you have to keep putting stuff out there. I mean, you'll know from podcasting, Nikki, it's the same in podcasting. You know, you have to be consistent. You have to keep putting stuff out there, and you have to have a strong sense of what you think is right and what you think is good, and just keep plugging away.
And having various fingers in lots of pies and talking to lots of different people and seeing what happens is, I do a bit of publicity and all sorts of different things as well. And some things work out, some things don't, as you say, and the ideas, and that will encourage a lot of people, you know, who are at home struggling to think. And in fact, some of the training I'd had before, or mobile journalism courses I've been on, they've said email someone 3 times, that's okay, because they could be busy twice. And lots of people don't, they email once and they think, oh, they're not interested, I won't contact them again. Whereas I think, you know, 2 or 3 times is fine. They might be busy, might say sorry to bother you, might not remember, you know, it just brings it to the top of the pile again, doesn't it? And that might help people as well from home, mightn't it? So you've written a number of books. Let's talk about your amazing books. You've written loads of books, including your first book, I Laughed, I Cried, with performing your 100 comedy gigs in 100 nights. But your new book, Lift As You Climb, about women and the art of ambition, came out really recently. And presumably you couldn't go on tour with that or do any of the book signings, because that literally was in March, wasn't it, when it was all closing down?
Yeah, Lift As You Climb came out on International Women's Day, so March the 8th, which was about, well, it's really about probably 2 weeks before we went into lockdown in the UK officially. But I went into my own personal lockdown about 3 days after that, because I was beginning to read the reports coming out of Italy. And I had traveled a lot in January and February. I was in Bermuda doing events. I was in Miami. I'd done a load of stuff in Geneva. I'd really traveled a lot in the first 6 weeks of the year. And I started to get quite nervous. And I'd done a lot of events as well. Like I'd done an event for 750 people. And then I did one in London for the launch for 300 people. And I was getting really nervous that I had come into contact with a lot of people. Although I had all tons of events lined up for Lift As You Climb, because the whole point of that message is getting in amongst other women, supporting them, talking about all of our problems together, addressing loads of the issues that you address on this podcast, trying to find solutions together. So the whole impetus of that book and How to Own the Room, my other book, and this is a kind of companion to go with that book, it's all about getting together and events and getting up on stage and all of that stuff. But I realized that it's not right. And so I took myself off my publicity schedule even before it was cancelled.
Yes, because you could see what was going to happen.
Oh yeah, I could see what was happening in Italy, and I just thought, it's not going to miss us. There's no way. Yeah, so initially I was a bit broken by all of this. I think as many people were, I sort of shut down really for about 3 weeks. I don't know if I had it or not. I was never tested, but I had something. I had like some sort of bronchitis or something. It might have been a mild version. And so yeah, I was ill, and I was really sad and disappointed and anxious and worried. But then, you know, time has moved on, and I think all of us are starting to adapt now to this weird kind of temporary situation that we don't know what it's going to morph into. And I found this incredible appetite for this conversation that I was trying to start with Lift As You Climb, about the idea of altruistic ambition. So the book is called Lift As You Climb, Women in the Art of Ambition. And what I wanted to do was reinvent this idea, ambition, for a new generation and a new age, because I was finding when I was doing a lot of work around How to Own the Room, all the events for that and the podcast that goes with that, that our conversation amongst women about owning space, showing up, really bringing your best self to the table in that kind of Oprah kind of way, a lot of women were really uncomfortable with doing that, because I felt they were saying, without actually saying it, that they were uncomfortable with the idea of being seen as too ambitious. And that question of ambition is still something that's kind of really knotty and sticky and horrible for people, that you don't want to be labeled as ambitious, but on the other hand, you don't want people to think you're unambitious. So where do you sit with all of that? And the more I thought about it and heard people talking about this without talking about it in the How to Own the Room events, which were ostensibly about public speaking, but people would be coming to those events with questions that were really about ambition. I came up with this idea of lift as you climb. And that if we can think of ambition as being something altruistic that we do for the sake of others, alongside others, taking them with us, that we can reclaim it from that kind of 1980s shoulder padded idea of, you know, Dynasty, Dallas, Alexis, Colby, ambition, which is just really fake anyway.
No, you're so right. And actually, ambition now has completely changed again because of lockdown, hasn't it? So in a way, you know, that brilliant title, Lift As You Climb, you know, kind of appeal to everybody, and helping people up the ladder, now they're all lost. I mean, you've touched on that, but in terms of being heard but not being pushy, helping other women find their voice and speak up, finding mentors and role models, and asking for more money, I know, are some of the topics you cover. And in fact, talking ambition, you know, what is ambition now in terms of, you've said in articles, it's the things we want, maybe for 2021, balance, space to think, creativity, travel and family. And actually all of those things now are even more important as ambition, aren't they?
Yeah, I think I'm really glad that this has happened in this way. I was listening to this amazing podcast with this woman called Lee Edelcourt. She's on this the Business of Fashion podcast, and she is a trend forecaster. And she was saying how, you know, this moment is terrible. Many people are suffering. Many people have died. Just from a social standpoint, in virtually any country, we can see that sort of consumerist capitalist path, that old-fashioned idea of what you might think of as ambition that grew up in the 1950s and then just blew up and blew up and blew up into the 80s. And then even beyond the financial crash, we've still been stuck in it. It's not sustainable on any level. And in Lee Edelcourt, when she talks about this, you know, she's in the fashion industry. And even she says, you know, fashion cannot continue the way it is. They were saying we create something like 18 billion garments a year now or something, like most of which end up in landfill. It's all so unsustainable. So yeah, I agree with you. I think everybody is starting to reevaluate what really matters. How much do we really need? How much do I really need to push myself? How much time can I take doing nothing? And ambition then becomes something completely different. So you become ambitious for peace and quiet.
Exactly.
Ambitious for your health, ambitious for mental health. And that channels as well this idea of altruistic ambition, that there's no point in individual ambition. There is no point. Like, what's the point of getting to the top of the tree if everything else around you is destroyed and there's nobody up there with you?
Well, it's inverted now, hasn't it? I mean, the people at the top of the tree are the people that should be, you know, the people that are paid too little, and the NHS and the key workers and the care workers who are still all out there. They're massively respected now, which is what was needed.
Yeah, well, it's sort of tragic that it takes something like this to show us how foolish we are.
And what a leveler it is. And actually what's lovely is seeing very famous people on TV in their own homes, in their loungewear and leisurewear, with their hair all over the place and whatever. And it's okay. And it's actually quite nice to see, isn't it, that you think it's okay to be similar. I think it could in fact be great timing for you with your book. And you talked about How to Own the Room as well in terms of self-confidence. I mean, in terms of How to Own the Room, did that come about from your own confidence and public speaking? Have you always enjoyed public speaking? I know some people have got a terror of it, haven't they?
Yeah, How to Own the Room really grew out of the big change that I made in my life in my mid-30s when I had three very young children. And I found that as they were growing up, I was saying to them, you know, when they would go to school and learn to read for the first time, I was saying, you know, you must always do what you want with your life and follow your dreams and don't listen to anybody else. And then the more I would sort of say this to them, and I really always wanted for my children that they should genuinely feel that and think that. And I believe that for everybody, that, you know, you can only know for yourself what's right for you and what counts as success for you. And I really began to take that to heart for myself. And as I was getting older and I was like looking at sort of 40 on the horizon and thinking, have I really done what I wanted with my life? You know, I love having my independence. I love writing. I'm so glad I don't have to work for somebody else. I love being freelance. But I felt like there was something missing. And that was when I started to perform comedy, because I had always wanted to write comedy, to perform, to do stand up. And I started doing that in 2009, the same year I had a miscarriage. So this was between my second and third child. So after my second child, I had a miscarriage. And that was a really challenging moment for me. It hit me really, really hard. I was quite depressed for a long time. And coming out of that, realizing, yes, I do really, really want a third child, and I'm going to try for a third child, even though I've had this disappointment. And I really want to be able to do what I want with my life, even if it's difficult and tough and risky. So that was what made me lean harder into comedy. And that was how I ended up, after my third child, Jack, was born in 2010, I ended up doing my 100 gigs in 100 consecutive nights. Yeah. And through all of that, I realized how many myths we tell ourselves about what's difficult, what you shouldn't do, what's supposed to make you feel sick, what's supposed to make you run a mile. And for most people, that is public speaking or showing up at work in some way that puts you in the spot or makes you feel under pressure. You know, for most people, it's not going to be doing stand-up, but the feelings that you get around doing stand-up are replicated for lots of us across lots of challenges that we face to do with work and to do with wanting to get on as well. You know, talking about this idea of ambition, you know, lots of people are held back from their ambitions because they're scared of putting themselves out there or really showing up and saying, oh no, actually I want to give a speech or I want to lead this Zoom call. That they're frightened of that. And How to Own the Room was really about having a conversation with loads of women, this is for the podcast, who have been through that and come out the other side, and trying to get them to go back in their minds to the time before they were good at it. So I'm talking about women like Hillary Clinton, Margaret Atwood, Mira Sayal, Catherine Tate, Mary Portas, Nigella Lawson, yes, Nadia Hussein, women from all different backgrounds and all different walks of life. And it's not just, you know, TV stars and celebrities. There are loads of different types of women on the podcast. It's asking them, what was it like for you the first time you were on television? What was it like for you the first time you gave a speech? How did you get over your nerves? And really trying to peel away those myths, because they really are myths, actually. When you've done a lot of public speaking and a lot of performing, you come to realize that everybody's the same and you don't need to be so fearful. And we put a lot of fear in our own way.
I think it's that fear of judgment, isn't it, being yourself? But I think that probably wanes as you get older. But no, that's interesting. And I'm sorry you went through that personal challenge. And in fact, our podcast, obviously the Influential Women podcast, is to help people smash adversity and stigmas and things they've suffered, personal health setbacks, you know, hard-hitting issues, and know that they can get through it and have that strength and stoicism as you've got and others have got, and to show they can get through it and they will be okay. And even hearing other people's stories like this helps other people, so thank you for that. And in fact, I was going to mention that, yes, I knew you'd interviewed Hillary and Chelsea Clinton, so that's amazing. So which strong men or women have inspired you?
Oh, so many. A lot of the people who inspire me are people that I haven't met, and that sounds, I don't want to be mean to anybody that I have met, because I have met so many people who have really inspired me. I mean, I've interviewed Judi Dench and Julie Walters.
Oh, well, they have been on my hit list for ages. Can you share them, please? Oh, how lovely.
Yeah, people who inspire me are people like, there's an American comedian called Tig Notaro. She's an actress, who's stand-up. She's in Star Trek Discovery. For any Trek heads out there, my 16-year-old is a massive Star Trek fan. And she became well-known when she did a comedy set at a New York club, just like on a Tuesday night, talking about having just received a cancer diagnosis. And the same day she got the diagnosis, she was supposed to go on and do a comedy set And you'd think that you might say, actually, I don't feel like it tonight. I'm just going to stay at home and process this information. But she decided to stick to her schedule and talk about it on stage. And somebody, it was recorded and it went viral online. And then she's kind of had a massive career afterwards. And she had, I think she had a mastectomy, and she is recovered and she's really healthy, and she got married, and I think they've got kids. And anyway, she's in a very good place, but she is a absolutely brilliant, brilliant risk-taking performer who, if you see her live, I've seen her live 3 times, she goes in all different weird directions with her comedy, and she plays off the audience, and she has the same kind of energy or style as like Eddie Izzard or Joan Rivers. She's lots of energy and quite kooky and surreal. And I really love people who show you something that you didn't know you wanted to see. That is what I love. Yeah. Is that's what I love about comedy as well, and live performance of all kinds is, oh wow, I wasn't expecting that, but I love it.
And that's bravery again, isn't it? Wow, that's interesting. So can we talk about your passions then? What do you do in your spare time?
Yeah, that's a funny question for me, especially for now, because right, what do we have other than spare time at the moment, right? Suddenly it's a very different world. Generally speaking, I would usually answer that question by saying, I don't have any spare time and I don't want any spare time, because all of my passions and interests and obsessions and little foibles and crazy things that I get really into, I put into my work. I've worked for myself for 20 years now. Anything that I love, I can put it in my work, and I can find a way to harness it in my writing or my performing or in people I want to interview, all of that stuff. But that's not to say that I am a bit of a workaholic, actually, I have to be honest. I love my work, but that's not to say that I don't do other stuff as well. And, you know, I will do anything to spend time with my kids. I love nothing better than just watching endless reruns of Saturday Night Live on YouTube with my 9-year-old Jack. He's obsessed with Saturday Night Live. And they have a series, a really old series on there. It's like about 10 years old now, called The Californians, that we watch all of the time, that I absolutely love. But I love going out with my friends and doing karaoke. That's a massive passion of mine that I was thinking the other day about karaoke, like, what's happened to all the karaoke bars? Nobody's inviting me to a karaoke Zoom. I love watching trashy TV. I'm pretty kind of, when I'm not full on doing work stuff, I'm pretty lazy, you know, so I just like watching TV and hanging out at home.
Now, I'm going to ask you your mantra for living your life, but I just want to ask if there are any empowering female brands or health and wellbeing companies out there that would like to sponsor or advertise on our show, please contact me at nikkibannermanradio.co.uk or support us on Patreon. That's Patreon. So do you have a mantra then, Viv, for living your life?
My mantra is, don't wait until you're ready, because if you do, you will never do anything. And anything that is worth doing is worth attacking it early. And then later on, you can perfect it. But I do see so many women waiting for the right moment, or, you know, we've all done it, right? And I'm not saying I'm not perfect at this, and I still wait to be ready with some things and then realize that I'm waiting and then make myself do it. But we've all thought, oh yeah, I'll do that when I've lost a couple of dress sizes. You know, I'll wear the bikini when I've lost 3 stone, or, oh yeah, I'll put in my application to do a TEDx talk once I've got a promotion. You know, it's always waiting and putting things off, or waiting to be asked, waiting to be chosen. No, don't wait to be ready. Really, it's about alpha culture. You know, we don't want all of the attention just to be on people who are super confident extroverts. There should be a voice for everybody. And that's true for men as well as women. And I think there are lots of different sort of population groups who get overlooked and feel like they should wait their turn or wait to be asked. But we don't live in a world now where you need to wait. You can just do it yourself and do it now.
Oh, brilliant. And hopefully that'll help a lot of people doing it now in these times. So lastly, what would you say to influence women and men, because we have men that listen to our podcast too, and we love men as well, so we're not trying to man bash them, but we love men. Viv loves men, she says. So what would you say to influence them listening out there?
I think I would want to influence people to relax and give themselves less of a hard time. And that is what is quite perversely beautiful about this moment is that many of us are being forced to let go, stop being attached to all of the busyness, all of the stress, all of the pressure. Just calm down, relax, and go deep, you know, go deep inside yourself and think about, what is it I really want? What is it I've been avoiding? What is the thing that really matters to me? And figure out a way to give yourself permission to do more of that thing.
And feel less guilty. I think that's the thing, is it's a good time for shifting the guilt of doing nothing as well, isn't it?
Guilt is a total and utter waste of time unless it influences your behavior. So if you're going to let it influence your behavior, like you feel guilty because you murdered somebody and you need to go and tell the police, please go and do that. But if you're feeling guilty about something like you're not a perfect mother or you didn't exercise 5 times this week, then either change your behavior and actually exercise 5 times this week, or spend more time with your kids, then don't waste time on guilt. Guilt is a total waste of time.
And that's where we'll end it. Thank you so much, Viv. Thank you for sharing your books and your life to help us change our mindsets and to lift others as we climb, or even catch them when they fall in these uncertain times, and to feel better about ourselves and life in general. So stay safe to you and everyone listening. Thank you, Viv. The Influential Women's Podcast is host presented and produced by Nikki Bannerman and co-founded with Juliet Nichols. This episode is produced and edited by Safran Mirza. Please subscribe for free. Keep listening for more podcast guests and our 3 years of back catalogue on all podcast platforms. And if you love what we do, please share and tell others. Thank you so much, Viv. Stay safe.